Welcome to Businesses of Tomorrow. Today in episode 3, can China be the launchpad for global success? So far, our founders have set their sights on some ambitious targets.
Our intention is to track, manage and protect over 1 million people by 2020.
We think we're going to double the business next year.
We want to be Australia's dominant self-drive marketplace.
Deliver better services to people with disabilities all around Australia and even around the world. Why not?
And they've had some insights from some of the most successful names in business, like Airbnb's Joe Gebbia.
One of the best ways to keep the startup culture and the startup vibe is to constantly tap into the intelligence of the people in your company.
This week, our founders have flown from the birthplace of the new economy, Silicon Valley, to the new kid on the block, China. The government in Beijing has ambitious plans to shift China away from being the factory of the world into a heavy hitter with global brands that reach into all corners of the globe. It's an ambition that's matched by the people.
The work ethic in China is extraordinary.
That's Scott Beaumont, head of Google China.
One of the companies that we deal with, their standard working hours were 9 a.m. to 10 p.m, Monday through Saturday.
China is open for business, and it's not just because the capital spirits of the Chinese people has been unleashed. President Xi Jinping understands that economic power is the best form of soft diplomacy, so ignore China at your peril. I'm Jackson Hewitt, a journalist with the Australian newspaper, and this is Businesses of Tomorrow, a podcast about how companies can make their mark on the world.
Now got some visibility through the smog, and it's 45 degrees, it was saying on the plane, so it's extremely bloody hot.
We're on a bus from Shanghai Airport to Pudong, the finance heart of the city. We've landed in the early morning after an overnight flight from San Francisco.
In America, yeah, there was just these businesses that have blown everything out of the water, and you're learning lessons about how they've done that.
Here's Will Davies, founder of peer-to-peer car sharing platform Car Next Door.
I'm expecting more here in China just to learn about just how this place works. It was like a business culture shock in America, but in China it's going to be a culture shock.
Will started his company because he was worried about global warming.
The pollution here is just, you know, to actually, I've seen the pictures, but to actually be here in that smog, you get a much greater understanding about why they've got environmental things at the top of the list.
China's breakneck growth has come at the expense of the environment, so the government is acting. Every 5 years, they issue a new blueprint for the economy, and in the past, the environment has lost out to industry. Now it is the other way around.
China is very, very serious about trying to eradicate and eliminate a lot of the pollution.
When trying to understand the world's second largest economy in the space of a week, you are going to need a lot of briefings. First up, Joanne Wood. She has lived and worked in China for 30 years, having come here as a student when it had just started going through its economic reforms. She is the founder of a boutique investment bank that finances deals between Australia and China, which means she keeps a close eye on economic opportunities.
The government here is very much like the board of directors and C-suite of any major corporation. The five-year plan is their mission statement, their goals, their strategy, right down through execution of the plan with targets. And every industry sector will follow this. It's reviewed monthly, quarterly, half-yearly, annually. It's important to understand in any five-year plan which industry sectors the country is targeting for development. And once you know those sectors, each industry will have a level of detail of targets they have to meet. You can review those and ensure that your own strategy for China reflects those, because it's really not much point coming here with a strategy that does not in any way reflect what it is the Chinese government is looking for.
So what are the opportunities for Australia?
That Australian players in the whole biotech, biopharma, medical devices, medical equipment areas have a huge, potentially enormous market in which to play. At the moment, in this current five-year plan, China is looking to get out of the manufacturing base for the world and out of a lot of polluted-oriented manufacturing, and therefore anything that involves green tech, clean tech, any area of technology will be very important to them and will be welcomed.
So tech is the focus in the current five-year plan, but big infrastructure projects are a perennial feature of Chinese growth. Christian Damstra of Damstra Technology has a software platform that matches both of those needs. For a business person like Christian, there's nothing like dealing with other business people.
Yeah, you have this vision of what the Chinese government is, and you sort of see them, I don't really want to use the word dictatorship because I don't really see them as that, but it was almost that level, it was my view. Whereas when you listen to the experts who have been here for some time talk about it this morning, they just say that they're effectively the C-suite of a company. They're running China as an incorporated company. And when you look at it from that perspective and you see the five-year plan that they put out, and they really have a plan, and I think that was really surprising to me and quite exciting at the same time, because my area of business does fit in their five-year plan.
Understanding where you fit in the five-year plan is a great way to position your business for the future. But as those plans roll out, there's plenty of opportunity now, particularly when it comes to a key Chinese demographic.
It is the young consumers which have the money.
Andrew Atkinson is an analyst at China Skinny, a market research firm. They advise the likes of Colgate, InterContinental Hotels and Tourism Australia.
If you think about it, you're a Chinese-only child. They're educated, they're part of China's new growth, and they've had great job opportunities with their education. You have your two parents and your four grandparents. You come from Shanghai and you've got all these properties behind you now worth tens of millions of dollars. And you have all this wealth behind you. I mean, why would you save 5,000 yuan a month and not spend it? It's a drop in the ocean compared to the wealth that you are going to inherit.
As a snapshot of economic history, China right now is a fascinating anomaly. Unlike in the West, where a graph of income by age would show low-paid youth and wealthy boomers, China is the opposite. Older Chinese came through the days of communism and later low-wage manufacturing jobs. So while the elderly hoard their savings from their lower salaries, it's the youth who are sitting pretty with high wages and a very rosy future. And that means very different strategies depending on the age group you're marketing to.
The post-80s, they still had a more humble upbringing, and that comes through in a lot of the ways you'll communicate with them. They're now parents, they're looking for different things. Post-90s have known only the good China. They're very individualistic. They do like to share and let known how well off they are or what they're doing.
So the key is knowing how to brand, something that Australian companies often get wrong, as Andrew demonstrates using a little quiz on the group.
Show of hands here, who thinks the most Australian image to a Chinese consumer is the map? Flag, boomerang, kangaroo, koala. Okay, so a bit of a split there. So it was overall the kangaroo. Well done, Team Kangaroo. Interestingly, in Tier 2 cities, it was the koala. So the map. So if you go have a look at any import food store in China, you'll see a lot of brands use the Australian map for some reason. Chinese people do not know what Australia looks like.
That was a revelation for Hannah, who sells her baby sleepwear in China.
We've actually just put the map of Australia on our packaging, and that's easy to change, and that's something quick that could result in, you know, better recognition.
A good lesson in not bringing your preconceived notions with you to a new market. But the opportunity is there. China's upper middle class, those earning between 20,000 and 40,000 a year, is expected to number 400 million people in the next 5 years. As they get richer, they'll be looking for higher-end goods and services. The market may be huge, but so is the competition, as our businesses found out at a visit to Australia's Trade Commission in Shanghai.
If you come up here, like a lot of companies still do, and say, oh, we're just going to go down to Hangzhou and do e-commerce with Alibaba, well, you're along with about 55,000 other companies that visit them this week, so they really don't care about you.
That is Matthew McKenzie, who helps Australian companies bring their products to China.
You've got to really understand what your brand proposition is and how that fits into the market, and then having laser-sharp execution on building that brand here. This is an extremely competitive market, and it continues to get more and more competitive. Everybody is here, from Belgium to Brazil.
And Americans too. That's the sound of thousands of Chinese going crazy for American basketball star Kobe Bryant in Shenzhen. He's also a star in China, partly in thanks to an Australian.
We're a sports digital consultancy, so we help the world's biggest sports organisations, companies like Man United, Liverpool, NHL, NFL, build a business in China through digital, media, commercial, sponsorship. We help them be loved, admired, followed.
Fifteen years after landing in China, Andrew Collins is not just making it, he's using it as a global launchpad. He has raised $25 million in China from some of the country's biggest venture capital firms, including from China's biggest basketball star, Yao Ming. Collins is riding a boom, one that you could not have predicted just 5 years ago.
People are now being more active. More people are playing European football. More people are playing basketball. They're playing ping pong. So sport's just now becoming part of the culture. And being an Australian, I always saw the value of sport and what that would have in the culture here. And timing was really everything for us.
Remember the five-year plan? Well, Andrew caught a big wave of it. Along with the clean and green theme of the last five-year plan, China wanted to get fit. And when China makes a plan, the money involved is huge. Sport is to be a $500 billion industry. 50 million kids will be playing soccer on 7,000 pitches, and the government wants Olympic success in basketball and winter sports like ice hockey. And what happens when you get millions of kids interested in sports? They want to watch the best. And in mobile-obsessed China, that is where Andrew Collins comes in.
The consumption of paid pay-per-view content has ballooned. I think it went up 1,000% over the last 12 months. I think if you went out to most professional sports teams, global football teams particularly, they will say China is their number one international market for the next 5 years. So we've been lucky to be there in the space at a certain maturity to capture a lot of those customers.
Collins has found a great niche by offering a conduit for foreign sports leagues to tap into China's increasing demand for experiences and entertainment. At the other end of the spectrum, Chinese companies have big dollars to buy in what they need.
For Fosun, the key criteria for looking for a target is whether we can bring a business that normally is already very successful and then bring the whole Chinese market to it.
That's Wang Zun, CFO of Fosun Group. Fosun have $100 billion in assets with 40 separate investment teams that scour the globe looking for takeover targets. They like entertainment too and bought Cirque du Soleil and Club Med. The Chinese middle class is where they see their growth.
I think in the coming 5 to 10 years, Fosun will do our business on the upgrading of the middle class consumption of Chinese families. And we think that there is huge opportunities there as Chinese are getting wealthier. And our focus will be health, happiness and wealth. Happiness is entertainment and tourism. This is based on the Club Med, which is now a fast-growing business for the group. Wealth is actually our wealth management business, mainly in insurance. And we are going to focus on the whole value chain of the healthcare that includes pharmaceutical, including medical equipment, but also baby care, senior housing, and also healthcare insurance.
Our founders have some good leads here. Baby care is a focus for Fosun, which is good news for Hannah. But she is cautious.
We know that there is huge potential in China, but I think that there's a misconception that you can come to China and make things successful. It's a very different landscape of how to do business, and I just think that having the right partner and waiting for the right partner is critical.
Jordan O'Reilly, whose tech platform HireUp helps people with disabilities, is more circumspect. He sees that health is a growing priority, but he's not sure whether in China's rush to prosperity, everyone is being included.
To be honest, it seemed like it was a bit of an embarrassing question when I asked about access for people with disabilities. You know, I sort of got met with a sort of a response that made me feel like maybe that's not, you know, certainly not a priority on the, for the government. Maybe that time is ahead of us. And so, yeah, very, very interested to keep an eye on what's happening. But we should definitely be just focusing on getting the model right before we think too far afield.
So social sector innovation is still in its infancy from Jordan's point of view. China has been focused on getting its people out of poverty after all. Certainly in its rush to generate wealth, it is made for some very rich people. The luxury business has been a booming one in China, and at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, that means catering to the most discerning of clients.
You know, you've got millennials who are in the workplace now who are extremely wealthy. And you'll see in this hotel, for example, that we engage with children at a very early age, Ritz Kids program, for example, and that shows that we're trying to create a guest for life.
That's Andrew Houghton, General Manager of Ritz-Carlton Shanghai Pudong. At every morning briefing, hotel staff are expected to recount a story of how they have wowed a guest. Even more extraordinarily, hotel staff have an allowance of $2,000 they are allowed to spend without management approval to solve a guest's problem. It can be to rectify an issue like replacing a damaged item or just adding a special touch to the guest's day.
A guest who stayed in the hotel, he arrived by taxi. He didn't have any change with him, so one of the bellmen went up and said, well, let me pay the taxi for you. So he paid the taxi for the guest. The guest then was amazed. He said, I can't believe your gentleman paid the taxi. What was more remarkable was he then completed a TripAdvisor review, and he said, I could not believe that somebody actually paid for my taxi. So that's where we bring that empowerment in. He was doing what it took to make sure that customer was happy.
For our founders, good ideas can come from anywhere. And for Hannah, such an idea was a stroke of genius.
Rather than going through 1,000 questions of what's wrong or what's right, they actually skip all of that and solve the problem before it's even kind of begun.
And what about in terms of Love to Dream? Are there things that you found out of today that you can apply in your business?
Yes, I think that we can shorten the time frame it takes for us to solve a consumer query. One email, that's enough.
A dinner that night with the Australian beer flowing Will Davies, whose peer-to-peer car sharing program should match China's environmental needs, finds himself in a heated discussion with a young Australian entrepreneur. Teresa Truder moved to Shanghai and launched a travel company to tap into that Chinese demand for new experiences. She sees a different opportunity for Car Next Door.
So many people tell you that, like, don't do direct to consumer. I think there's total market here. There is one car brand that I recognise as a foreigner, like car sharing brand, and I think there's huge potential.
It's annoying that you've said this because I nicely compartmentalised in my head that China was a write-off and I should just stick with Australia. And now you're like, no, you should do it. I'm like, ah.
I actually think that you should come here and try and validate the market, but it might be different to the Australian consumer that needs to get from A to B. It might be something about, like, luxury. I'd like to be seen in a Maserati, but I can't afford one.
Yeah.
See if there's that kind of thing.
Maseratis next door? It's a bit of a departure from Will's anti-materialistic, environmentally sound car sharing model. What does he think?
There's been a bit of a theme that if you're a foreign brand that is thinking about coming to China, that it's going to be pretty hellish to do it. Like, the feeling that I've got is that, you know, the competition will be fierce. They'll sort of outwork you, out capital raise you, and they're just, because they've got the better cultural understanding of what's going on in China, they'll just beat you, and so you kind of better not bother. But yeah, it's interesting to hear what Teresa was saying. No, that's not true. So her experience has been that she has been able to find a bit of a niche. Here's where I'm at with it. I think that it seems like if you're a luxury, well-known Western brand, that's, yeah, you can really smash it here. For the online brands that aren't a brand, which is what Car Next Door would be if we're entering here, I think we'd really struggle. Look, here's the potential argument. Like, if they're going to go and buy the Audis and stuff anyway, if we can create a way that we can sort of fulfil their consumer desires, but we have one Audi serving four or five people, then that's going to kind of help our aim. But I mean, just the scale of the city and the amount of pollution and stuff. These guys don't need more cars. They need to rethink a complete other way of doing it.
So Will can't see a viable path to success in China and is not sure if he has the solution in any case. How about Christian?
If you're going to come to the Chinese market, you want to move very, very fast when you come here, because you're not dealing with a few thousand people, you know, you're dealing with billions of people. And even if you hit one city, you're dealing with 30 million people. You're not dealing with 2 or 3 million people. So get ready to go fast, and I don't think that we're ready for that speed.
Jordan?
One of the fascinating insights for me is around the healthcare system more generally, and you know, understanding how lucky we are in Australia to have a welfare system like an NDIS, or you know, the sort of support that we have for you know, other sections of the community, such as the aged care sector. Here in China, you know, it was made very clear that that's not been you know, welfare system for more disadvantaged members of the society hasn't really been a focus in the last sort of at least 50 years. And while Australia is a lot smaller of a place and a lot fewer people, the support systems in place are really are, you know, world class.
So what about Hannah? China's demand for baby products has already been a huge money spinner for other Australian companies. Can it work for Love to Dream too?
What's interesting is the desire of the Chinese consumer to make good impact on the world, and that's something that I think is new knowledge for me, and that they want green products, they want to make sure they're made in ethical factories, and they want to know that they're not having an environmental impact through their purchases, and we can give them that certification and give them that assurance. So that has been really valuable for me.
Sunny Sydney town. You will, however, need your jumper this morning.
So, as a whirlwind trip concludes, our founders have plenty to work with to grow their businesses of tomorrow. Will still has to raise his capital, Christian to take the leap to America to chase much bigger clients, Jordan to manage runaway growth, and Hannah to see if she can convince Target to range her items. Next week, we'll be following our founders to see how they put what they learn into practice and hopefully find out some good news. This podcast has been brought to you by The Australian Newspaper. It has been created in partnership with Westpac Bank, and all the companies featured in this episode are the winners of Westpac's inaugural Businesses of Tomorrow program. To find out how you can apply to the program, go to businessesoftomorrow.com.au. I do hope you've enjoyed this podcast. There is plenty more to come in this series, so stick with us. And if you did like it, please give us a rating on your favourite app or tell a friend or two. We'd love this podcast to scale. It was produced and reported by me, Jackson Hewitt, mixed by Taylor Denny, and the consulting producer was Catherine Franey. Until next week, goodbye.